Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm your host, Jeff Hayden. Joining me as tonight's co-host is David Begeleisen. For some weeks, we've been looking at and lamenting over current events. Our discussion tonight will be a bit different. Tonight, we take a look at forensic science, that is, where science meets law. Our discussion might include such items as good science versus junk science, and such questions as, how do we train lawyers to present science in court? How did judges decide which evidence to allow juries to hear and which to reject? What is the state of science education in our country? What's the state of scientific inquiry and research in our country given the current political climate? If I sound a little unsure about our conversation, we're still waiting to hear from you, our final and most important guest. And there's much to discuss. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. If you want to call in a related question about science in the law or science in the courtroom, you don't have to jump in exactly where we are in our conversation. And bear in mind that our guests are here to educate. They can't provide you legal or scientific advice about your particular case or your living situation. They haven't seen all the facts. David Begeleisen, welcome. Good evening.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Tell us who's going to be joining us tonight.
We are really lucky to have two spectacular guests this evening, a law professor and a scientist. Our law professor is David Fagman. David is the Chancellor and Dean of the University of California College of Law in San Francisco. He is one of the leaders in forensic science. He has written books and articles on forensic science, and he has taught throughout the country and throughout the world on this subject. He was one of the reporters to the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology in the monograph that they wrote in 2016 addressing various subjects of forensic science, that is, science and the law. Sitting next to him is Bruce Alberts. Professor Alberts is a professor at the University of California School of Medicine in San Francisco. He is a biological chemist. Dr. Alberts was the president of the National Academy of Sciences, the president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the editor of Science Magazine, and he was the recipient of the National Medal of Science. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, David. Good to be here.
To both of you, welcome to Your Legal Rights. Before we start, can I ask a big question? I'm going to take a big step back after this one. But for our listeners, what is forensic science?
So I'm happy to take that. Forensic science is essentially, as you mentioned, where science meets the law. Primarily when we think about forensic science, we're thinking about criminal cases. So in some ways, it's easier to describe content areas rather than forensic science as a general subject. So, for example, it used to be thought that the gold standard was fingerprint evidence, and then DNA really replaced that as the gold standard. But it includes everything from bite mark analysis, which is highly problematic, shoe pattern comparisons, tool marks and firearms examination, arson investigation, shaken baby syndrome. So there's a whole panoply of different kinds of areas where the forensic scientists seek to prove legally relevant questions that come up in the courtroom day after day.
Before we go further, with my permission of our guests, I would like to tell a story. I was in court in San Mateo County arguing a case before a judge, and at the end of the hearing, the judge said, well, we need to set another session to talk about something else in the case. He looked at his calendar. He said, we're going to come back at 9 o'clock on such and such a date. I reached into the breast pocket of my coat, pulled out my pocket calendar, and I said, "I'm sorry, Your Honor. I have to be in court in San Francisco at that time. And in quantum mechanics, you can be in two places at the same time, but not in Superior Court." The judge looked up at the ceiling. He looked back down again. He smiled, and he said, "I was a history major." Now, perhaps that sets the stage for the rest of our conversation. Now, we've talked about what is forensic science. Why is this important now? How come it's coming up in court?
Well, I think it's always been important, David. I would say that probably it's coming up most obviously because of a decision that the United States Supreme Court made in 1993. The case name is Daubert versus Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals. So prior to 1993, the basic standard in the courtroom, and is still true in California, New York, Illinois, was that the standard for admitting scientific evidence was under a test called the Frye test. And the Frye test asked judges to assess whether the scientific evidence, opinion testimony that was being offered was generally accepted in the particular field from which it came. And so judges didn't need to know very much science. They simply needed to be able to count noses of scientists. And if the question was whether arson investigation was generally accepted, you asked the fire marshals, "Raise your hand if you think that this is generally accepted." In 1993, when the Supreme Court and it was the first time they ever did this, considered the question of what should be the admissibility standard, what should judges have to do before allowing scientific evidence into court, they said that the Frye standard did not apply in federal court, and that the standard was a standard that required them to be gatekeepers, and that required them to evaluate the methods and the principles, to understand the research design, to understand the statistics underlying scientific evidence that was being offered in court. And Chief Justice Rehnquist famously said in a concurring and dissenting opinion that although he had ultimate respect for federal judges, he wasn't sure that judges should be amateur scientists. And Daubert arguably created a regime where judges were expected to actually understand the science under the evidence, scientific evidence that was being offered in court. And so since 1993, there have been debates about whether a lot of the areas of forensic science actually have a foundation, a scientific literature that demonstrates that what they're offering in court is indeed reliable and valid.
Well, David, what are the elements, the guideposts, that the judges are supposed to look at when they do a Daubert evaluation?
So the fundamental question is whether the judge is persuaded, more likely than not, what's called the preponderance of the evidence standard, that the underlying basis for the expert testimony that's being offered in court is reliable and valid. And so the Daubert case itself offered certain guideposts to help lawyers, to help judges, one of which was that it has to be testable and that it had to be adequately tested. A second was error rate, although the court never said what error rate would be satisfactory. A third factor was whether the sciences being offered in court had been subjected to peer review and published in a peer-reviewed journal prior to getting to court. And the fourth one was the old Frye test, which was whether achieve general acceptance among scientists and practitioners in the field.
Let me step aside and ask Bruce, why is the testing of the science important? How does that fit into the scientific method and how scientists think?
Yeah, well, science is very much a special discipline that has a tradition that goes back hundreds of years of it's been very important for the world and for the advance of knowledge in the world and for our lives every day. But basically, over time, methods were developed that scientists would make an observation, but it wasn't really respected until somebody else had actually been given a chance to independently confirm or extend or refute what that scientist said. So that meant when scientists wanted to claim something, they had to make it possible for other scientists to do exactly the same experiment that they had done or make the same observation. So that led to this whole tradition when you as a scientist, your whole reputation depends on publishing findings. But not only publishing them, you have an obligation to make all your data accessible and all your methods and even where you bought every reagent so that another scientist anywhere in the world could test to see whether you made this up or made a mistake or whether this is true. So over time, this method of community testing each other that has led to a whole range of critical knowledge that we rely on every day and made our lives incredibly more healthy and safer and easier on all the technologies that have come. You know, I just some staggering to recognize that, you know, 100 years ago or so, maybe 150 years ago, something like half of all children under 10 died before they got to the age of 10. And, you know, today, you know, we don't think our children will die because they generally won't. But in the old days, everybody had to count on half their children dying. All these kinds of things came out of science, the understanding infectious disease, you know, all these wonderful things. But it depends on a community effort and a cross-checking. Peer review is part of that. But it's really scientific knowledge is a community knowledge. It's not what one scientist does. It comes out of the community cross-checking each other.
So speak to Bruce's point, what's interesting is that forensic science did not come from science and did not come from scientists. When you look back at the early part of the 20th century, when a lot of these ideas and fingerprints go back to the 19th century, but firearms and tool mark identification, where firearms experts claim to be able to identify a cartridge case or bullet as having come from a specific or particular gun, which started around 1915 and then was actually some of the evidence introduced in the St. Valentine's Day massacre, virtually all the forensic sciences, except DNA profiling, came out of police labs, didn't come out of the mainstream academic scientific community. And so they had the hypotheses, they had the theories that Bruce was just talking about, but they didn't test them, they didn't evaluate them, and they would come into court thinking that things like handwriting identification or arson identification or fingerprints were true because they had the theory that supported the logic of their testimony. So it's sort of like, you know, one of my favorite examples, for over 1,000 years, doctors bled people because they thought that was an effective therapy against congestive disorders. It wasn't until the 19th century that they did clinical testing bleeding people to see if it actually worked. And so the forensic sciences are somewhere stuck in around the 18th or 19th century in their level of scientific sophistication.
Well, and really in preparing for this session, I read one of David's papers, and I was astounded to see that there is not a system of independent scientific research on these methods. I mean, I would have thought that the Department of Justice or somewhere would have a competitive grants program or embed something in the National Institute of Science and Technology, NIST labs, where independent testing of, you know, if you want to see how reliable fingerprints are, you have to do experiments and actually see if you could reproduce results and find what fraction of the time you're actually correct or not. But as far as I could tell, this has not been done independently as a tradition in the law, which surprises me.
Yeah, no, it's the Justice Department does not have an incentive to do it because the courts are allowing it to be admitted. And until this forensic science is systematically challenged and courts step up and start excluding some of the testimony that's being offered by these forensic scientists or forensic examiners, because they're mostly not scientists, as soon as courts start doing that, I think the research will will be done.
But isn't
which
that
is exactly backwards?
Isn't that part of the problem? Lawyers by nature are not trained in science. A few are, maybe the ones that are doing intellectual property and the like. But those that are litigating every day typically don't have that background.
Yeah.
So they're stepping away rather than challenging the new science that's being introduced.
That's correct. The fact of the matter is, most people that go to law school are like the judge that David alluded to, who were history majors. I would say that most people who go to law school met their match in math somewhere along the way, whether it was ninth grade algebra or college calculus. There was some point in time where being a scientist was no longer a practical alternative for a career path. And so they become judges, and they don't understand hypothesis testing. They don't understand the culture of science, as Bruce so nicely described it. And we need to find a way to bring that scientific culture and that sophistication about being a good consumer of science into the court somehow. But I taught for years a class called Scientific Methods for Lawyers, which, of course, is a very sexy title. So, you know, everybody wants to line up to be in that class. And I, of course, kid. But the I taught it with a great evidence professor, Roger Park. And we used to have to offer the probability theory, statistics, and research design separately for the exam and make it a pass-fail exam. Otherwise, the law students wouldn't want to take the class. And so the legal doctrine we taught by giving a grade, but the statistics and the research design, we gave a pass-fail exam because there is such a phobia among people who go to law school for understanding basic science and basic statistics.
Well, you know, of course, you know, they don't have to do the research. They just have to respect the research. But first of all, the research has to be done.
Yeah.
If nobody's doing it, then it's really you're stuck. I'm reminded of one of the very first studies of the Academy did when I came there in 1993 as president was try to answer the question, should there be a Department of Science in the United States to fund all science? And the chair of that committee was my predecessor, Frank Press, who had been president of the Academy for 12 years before that. And they concluded, no, it was very important that every department of the government have their own scientific research. The Department of Energy needs to have theirs. Something that's very much in the news today. NOAA has to have theirs if they're going to do good work on weather and disasters and stuff. And I would assume the Department of Justice would have to have theirs for forensic science. But although many of those other departments do have their own research programs that are effective, I'm surprised that this never happened in the field of law.
Well, Bruce, I'm going to remark on that. The National Academy was founded by President Lincoln and the Congress in 1863 with the specific charge of advising the president on scientific matters. Some presidents have been very interested to learn about that, others less so. We'll talk about that at the very end of the program. Is this a good time to talk about which areas of forensic science are good and solid?
Yes, probably is a good time. You have to start with DNA. As Bruce knows, there are two major National Academies reports in the 1990s on DNA profiling. DNA has the virtue of having come from mainstream academic science. And so both the DNA molecule and Watson and Crick's work led to the theories that were then demonstrated through originally what was called restriction fragment length polymorphisms to identify DNA profiles.
Can you tell us what that means, please?
Bruce might be able to tell you that better than I could.
It's a very primitive technique. Nobody would do it these days.
Right. Now they use polymerase chain reaction, the PCR.
There were enzymes that recognize specific nuclear sequences of DNA and cut at those points. They're enzymes that come out of bacteria to protect themselves from foreign DNA, and that won a Nobel Prize actually. But it's a wonderful tool that started the very basic to the revolution in DNA technology that we now have extended enormously. I mean, today you could sequence the whole human genome of anybody for a couple hundred dollars. It's just amazing. One of the distinguished scientists, Francis Crick, who was one of the co-discoverers of the structure of DNA, had proposed long ago that was before sequencing was so cheap, that every child born should have their DNA sequenced.
Yeah, very controversial.
I wonder how you feel about that, because that would make forensic science even more powerful.
It would. I think the virtue, as I mentioned, of DNA was that it was a solid, mainstream scientific discovery that was fashioned for use in the courtroom.
Yes.
When you look at fingerprints or tool marks in firearms or other areas that are used, they really came out of these police laboratories, and they were never really in a solid position. And as Bruce put it, you want to evaluate whether they can actually do what they purport to do. And then the challenge, of course, is when you then test it and it turns out not to be true, you have sometimes many people that were convicted under bad science. And then the question is, do they have access to post-conviction relief, and should their convictions be possibly overturned? But one really nice example, this is, I think, for me, a very clear statement of where the problem and where things went off the tracks and how we might be able to get them back on the tracks. It used to be before 1995 that fire investigators would testify to a phenomenon called glass sprawling. And so the glass in a fire would sometimes have like a spider web pattern on it. And the theory was that when you had a spider web on the glass, it was an indicator of an accelerant like gasoline, and therefore it was an indicator of arson. And they would testify for decades that this kind of evidence was an indicator that arson had occurred. And in the early 1990s, there was the fire in Oakland, and a gentleman named John Lentini, very smart investigator, was walking around the fire, and he noticed that in the interior of the fire that there was no of the sprawling happening on the glass. But at the perimeter of the fire, the glass was all had this spiderweb pattern. And he thought, well, that's odd. That's actually the opposite of what the hypothesis was. So he went to the local Ace hardware store, bought some glass, bought an acetylene torch, went into his basement for about $15 and tried to heat the glass at different rates to see if he could make it get this spiderweb pattern, and he couldn't do it. And so he then had an idea, and he heated the glass, and he threw cold water on it. It sprawled. It turned into a spider web. So it turns out that they had been testifying that the spider web in glass was an indicator of arson, when actually and rapid heating, when it turned out that it was actually an indicator of rapid cooling. They don't testify to that anymore.
Well, David, that might be an example of a lot of instances where things that are held up to be forensic science are really much less science than they are lore. Is that accurate?
I think that's a very fair statement. Mm-hmm. And then over time, and this is where the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Daubert, I think, has changed to some extent the expectations in court, that at least the judges should ask the question that Bruce asked, which is, have you tested it? Where are the data? And a lot of the forensic examiners say, we don't need data. We are relying on our experience and our training, and that gives us the answers that we're looking for. And so they're not, again, they're not part of the scientific culture of having independent testing be done.
This raises another question. How are these investigators trained? Do they have some special certificate to be in?
Yes. They're very often certified by a group called the Association of Firearms and Tool Marks Examiners, AFTI, and different specialties. But all these are very much like the American Bar Association, the American Psychological Association, or the American Psychiatric Association. They're all essentially guilds that are protecting their members.
I see.
And then they are also taught in their specific specialty And so they may all be repeating their same processes. So I was on the National Academies Committee that looked at the scientific validity of polygraphs. And one of the interesting things we found, because a lot of the polygraphers are taught at the Department of Defense Polygraph Institute, and so they're all using the same technique, the same protocols, but what we found was they were very reliable in terms of being consistent with each other, but they weren't valid. They weren't accurate. And so you can have a situation where you are completely reliable and consistent using the right protocols, but completely wrong. And that's what happens in a lot of these areas, is that they're taught to do protocol A, B, C, and D. If you do A, B, C, and D, you get an answer, but whether the answer is correct or not, it needs to be independently evaluated.
That raises an interesting question. What happened after the Academy Polygraph report to the use of polygraph?
interesting. Great question. You probably know the answer. It was presented to Congress. The question was whether senior scientists at places like Sandia and Los Alamos should be subjected to polygraphs. Yeah. And Congress thanked the National Academies for the committee's report, and then everybody ignored it. They continue to use polygraphs. And the reason why is that the CIA, the FBI, the Department of Defense really are not interested in the accuracy of polygraphs. They use polygraphs as a interrogation device. And we used to say, the committee used to say, you could hook people up to a Xerox machine and get exactly the same results, because as long as the people being subjected to the polygraph think that it's going to detect deception or lies, then they will confess. And so it's a great prop, but you could use a Xerox machine for the same result.
I defended that case. The case where a polygrapher who was a skilled, formerly FBI polygrapher, actually used the back of a Xerox machine, convinced this guy that he was being detected on a lie detector. 8.5 hours one day, 6.5 the day before.
Mm-hmm. And confessed.
Oh, of course. And that created a great appellate record. It came back, as you might imagine.
Yeah. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit about what's solid and what's doubtful and what is no good at all. We've talked about DNA. How is DNA used to identify people who have committed crimes, and how is it used to identify people and exonerate them?
So DNA, of course, is found in every cell. It is used because if you have single sample DNA, so one person is involved in it, it's highly accurate. If you look at the basic theory is that the locations, the alleles, the places where you're looking in the DNA, every single one of them, let's say you're looking at 13 places in the cell, if you're looking at 13, the likelihood of finding one might be 30%. The likelihood of finding number two might be 60%. The likelihood of finding number three might be 48%. And since the likelihood that each one of those would happen is independent, meaning they don't depend on one versus the other, you can use a very simple statistical formula called the product rule to multiply those numbers to get numbers that you get, like there's a 1 in 6 million or 1 in 6 billion chance of finding this profile if you randomly looked in the population. Yeah. So you get what's called a random match probability.
Well, the technology has really dramatically improved since the old days of DNA testing. And now, you know, everybody has a unique DNA sequence that's unique to them. Nobody else has exact sequence. So with modern technology, in principle, you could positively identify people if you got a good DNA sample. I think all you need is one hair.
Yeah, that's right.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM. I'm Jeff Hayden, joined by David Bigelais, and tonight we're looking at where science meets the rule of law with the help of co-host David Bigelaisen of San Francisco, David Feigman, the dean of UC College of Law, San Francisco, and Bruce Alberts, a past president of the National Academy of Sciences, awarded the National Medal of Science by former President Barack Obama. If you have questions for our guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. If you're outside the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. As always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic, where science meets the law. You're not limited to the exact point where we may be in our conversation. And we'll be back right after this.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Support for KELW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. That's 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. Now back to Your Legal Rights with Jeff Hayden, or should we even call it Your Legal Rights with Jeff and Friends?
And before we go on, I'd like to turn it over to Tyrone in Richmond with a DNA question. Tyrone, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. So my cousin Marcus got convicted of a crime, and he said he wants to do DNA to prove his innocence. Does that stuff get corrupted? Like, are they going to say, yeah, it didn't prove anything, thanks for playing? Or are they going to go, yeah, we'll do it and give him an honest look because he says he didn't do it?
Jeff, why don't you speak to that?
Sure. I'm not quite sure I understood the entirety of the question. I got that your cousin Marcos was convicted, but talk to me a little bit about your DNA question.
Yeah, so they did like skin or blood samples and said, yeah, it's a match, you're the guy. And so he said, well, let me give you like an updated swab or whatever, or hair, whatever, because I don't think it was right the first time, and that ain't me. So do they jerk people around with those DNA samples and just make it up on the fly? Or, I mean, does that ever happen, or are they like 100% foolproof?
I would simply say that you definitely want to have a good lawyer look into it. I don't think that any human endeavor is free of corruption. I think that as a general matter, DNA is the gold standard. And when they have a single sample, it's, you know, quite powerful evidence. Certainly laboratories, you know, they say that, you know, if you get a 1 in 600 million figure, that's pretty powerful evidence. However, the possibility of laboratory error, mixed samples or other things that might happen 1 out of, you know, 50 times or 1 out of 20 times.
That's what I'm saying.
And okay. So you would probably, you know, you'd want to get it retested. And, you know, one of the cornerstones of science is replication. And that should be true for evidence as much as it is for any kind of scientific investigation.
There are lawyers who specialize in reopening the case, getting this stuff retested, working on your conviction. The California Innocence Project, for example, has lawyers that are working on that with various cases. There's also experts that they're not going to go out and retest the DNA. They're going to go and look at the bench notes, look at the lab notes. They're going to look into exactly what this testing lab did that gave you those results in the first place and whether they see flaws in the techniques that were applied.
Which then leads me to one other area of science, and that is drug testing. Is the science of drug testing solid?
I think it is, for the most part. Again, the question is the between the technology that's available and the application of the technology. And so I think that when it comes to blood alcohol levels and drug testing, that the technology is there and is quite accurate. But I do think that where you see problems arise is with the human dimension of actually carrying out the tests, then presenting the tests, mixing up samples, and other things. So it's one thing to ask, you know, are the protocols available? In a lot of areas, like, you know, bite marks and footwear impression and firearms and tool marks, the technology is not there in the first place. So no matter how good the humans are, the technology doesn't get you there. But in other areas like DNA, drug testing, blood alcohol levels, the technology is there if the humans carry it out correctly.
I want to pick up on that theme just a bit, and that is from time to time, there'll be a scandal in the police lab where, for example, the people who are supervising the lab are not supervising adequately, and sometimes the people in the lab will be taking the drugs home to sample themselves or not calibrating the instruments properly and so forth. There was an instance in San Francisco where one of the lab techs had some personal problems. She was taking the cocaine home, and it was found out through another problem that she had. And the DA had to dismiss hundreds of cases because the lab had simply not been following adequate quality control programs.
That's a huge problem. I think one of the recommendations of the 2009 National Academies report was to separate the labs from the police and from the prosecutors. The Houston lab is a good example of that had a great deal of corruption, a great deal of fraud going on. But the Houston lab now is run by an absolutely brilliant director, Peter Stout. It is independent of prosecutors and police, and they do everything they can to bring the best work to the evidence that they are evaluating. I think when the lab is part of the prosecution team, there's going to be pressure and demands that they get it right from the prosecution's perspective. That's not the purpose of the justice system. The purpose of the justice system is to get it right, not to get it right to serve the prosecution.
Russell. Let me turn it over to Peter from Tampa, Florida. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you. Now, I'm telling you about a story because a friend of mine told me that this is from the 19th century. It was the first court case decided based on statistics, okay, which is science. And what happened was they were looking at a will and someone presented a codicil. And they were looking and saying, is this codicil legit? And they looked at the signature on it, and the signature on it was exactly the same as another signature. And the case that was made was that there's always a little variation in the, you know, every time you write your signature, it's not exactly the same ever, but the signature on the codicil was exactly the same as another signature that they found. And so they said, this must be a forgery. It's too perfect. Have you ever heard of that case?
Not specifically, but it sounds like a great case for me to look up. So thank you for that.
Doesn't it sound like a Columbo episode?
It is. I mean, it certainly suggests that it was traced as opposed to, because I know that my signature certainly changes from time to time. There actually, again, after the Supreme Court decided the case in 1993, requiring judges to be gatekeepers, prior to 1993, no researchers had done any testing on handwriting identification expertise. And then very quickly, about a half dozen studies were done. And there's a great deal of question as to the accuracy of that. Now, of course, you're presenting a somewhat different question of the sort of hypothetical statistical reality of whether somebody can repeat their signature perfectly. And that ends up being much more of a common sense kind of a judgment, and I'm not sure other than, so the way you test a lot of these forensic sciences is what's called, you use what's called a black box methodology. And a black box methodology is very simple. You know the input, and you can evaluate the output. So in firearms and tool marks, for example, if you create the sample of cartridge cases or bullets, and you know which gun they came from, you can test examiners by giving them these samples and see if they got it right or they got it wrong. And it doesn't really matter what's happening in the black box, what's happening in the examiner. You can determine if they're right or wrong. And the same kind of testing can be done in your example of handwriting, where you create certain handwriting samples, you know the author of those handwriting samples, and then you determine whether an examiner is getting it right or wrong. You may not know why they're doing it, but if they're good at it, then there might be an expertise that's worth bringing into court.
And do you know whether there have been any studies on handwriting analysis?
On personality or
not
identification.
Not personality, for identification purposes.
Yes, there's been about half a dozen studies on identification.
And what did they find out?
That generally they're not very good at it.
Okay. Should we talk a little bit about things that people are not very good at?
Sure.
How about, let's talk about bite marks.
So bite marks, and I present to judges a lot, and I say to them that 25 years from now, bite marks will be Exhibit A for they're not doing their jobs very well if they continue to admit it. There are lots of examples where bite mark experts, they use a blue light or something, which somehow is going to make it more accurate as a technology. But there are lots of examples, and most virtually all the research indicates that they actually call themselves forensic odontologists, which makes it sound very impressive, but they're not very impressive, in fact.
Well, but the bite will have DNA in it, so why not use that instead?
It's a very good question, and they do, and it should replace it. Yeah. It would be a bite mark that did not have the DNA.
Yeah.
And another example where DNA can play a role is hair identification. So again, for decades, examiners would look into a comparison microscope and compare hair. And they would testify that the hair found at the crime scene matched the defendant's hair. Turned out that all of that was just terrible science. But of course, you can get DNA from the root of the hair. And so that was actually one of the grounds that they understood how bad hair analysis was. So again, it was admitted for decades. And then years ago, more than a decade ago now, the FBI decided that they would no longer use hair comparison analysis.
I have a question. Is there an outstanding graduate school of forensic analysis? I mean, there should be.
There are graduate programs in forensic science.
Yes.
There's one at GW, which is a very good university. There's one at West Virginia University, another very good school. But they don't study the underlying hypotheses.
Yeah.
And most of the folks there are trained more in chemistry and biology and not statistics. And so when I confronted forensic examiners in different contexts, it's really interesting to see that most of them have this science background in chemistry and biology, but the true testing of the value of their expertise would come from statistical studies, not from basic chemistry and biology.
You know, if they were like other graduate programs, they'd be doing research as well. If there were research grants available to do the kind of work that we were talking about needs to be done.
And that's a big problem in this area, that there are no research grants available. Long before the current administration, there were no research grants available to do this kind of basic research.
Let me ask you from a more practical viewpoint. What can one do to make sure that the judge is fulfilling his or her role as a gatekeeper and that your attorney has the key to open the gate when appropriate?
Well, it's a good question. I think that lawyers are struggling with that day in and day out. You hope that And I have a great deal of respect for judges. As I mentioned, I present to judges pretty regularly. They're a great audience. They have to actually deal with this on a day-to-day basis. But most, take example, California Superior Court judges, they're very, very busy. They don't have typically clerks to help them investigate more deeply some of the scientific evidence that's coming before them, and they have to get through the case very quickly. And so from a judge's perspective, it's easier to simply say, well, I'm going to let the evidence come in for what it's worth and allow you, through the adversarial process, to challenge it on cross-examination before the jury or put on your own expert if that's what you wish to do, and then the jury will make a decision based on that. But, of course, juries don't have any more scientific sophistication than do the judges. And under the rules of evidence, the judge has an independent responsibility not to allow bad science in. And as I mentioned earlier, one of the benefits of judges stepping up to say, this should not be admitted. Tool mark analysis should not be admitted the way it's being presented in court. Arson investigation, if it hasn't been demonstrated to be valid, should not be admitted to court. What that will actually do is exactly what Bruce is asking for, which is having independent scientists begin researching this subject matter. But as long as the prosecutors get to keep on putting on bad science, then the incentive to actually test that science is not there at the same level as it would be. The Justice Department would be all over these questions if all of a sudden it was being excluded left and right, and then they'd want to do the research to figure out, you know, what's good and what's not so good and as to what's being admitted into court.
Could I ask you, David, what about other countries? Are other nations that do this better than we do?
Not really. A lot of the forensic science is admitted in other countries. The benefit that some countries have is that they have more of an inquisitorial system, and so the judges are the fact finders. So take the Netherlands, for example. The experts are much more likely to appear before the judge. I did a case. I was an expert in a case in Israel. In Israel, it was a three-judge panel in a criminal case evaluating all of the evidence, including the scientific evidence. So they're an appellate-type panel, and so there are several judges, some of whom may know it better than the other judges. The other example, so a lot of what I would have suggested over my career is that judges need help. And the question is, how do you help them? And one possibility is to have court-appointed experts. And most state rules and the federal rules provide that a judge can hire an expert. They can either hire an expert as a court-appointed expert that can help the jury as well, or as what's called a technical advisor to just help the judge understand the science. But judges don't like that as an option because they think it undermines the adversarial process and takes away some of the power of the attorneys. One of the things that we were talking about before the program started, in Australia, they do something that's like that, but they bring in three or four experts. And the three or four experts will actually talk among themselves in the courtroom about what's good, what's not so good about the science. And, of course, it's Australia, so they have a great name for it. It's called hot tubbing. So it's like they all sit around in a hot tub and they talk about the scientific evidence. But you get different perspectives, and I think it really advances the causes of justice.
One of the other problems I see with that is would it be, at least in my mind, unless we're going to invest a lot more money in the court system, it's going to be hard to keep the trains running on time if we don't invest a lot more in judges, knowing that we're going to be slowing how much time they spend on each case. They're going to need to spend more time learning the science while everything else is in a timeout.
That, and I would just add, beyond DNA, and DNA is so well established, most of these are not rocket science. The bad science is coming in, like bite marks and what's called comparative bullet lead analysis and shaken baby syndrome and lots of these other areas. When you actually look at it, in most cases, there's no research at all, or the research violates fundamental tenets of research design and statistics. And so one value here is that once judges get up to speed on some issues, they ought to recognize the problems in others. And one of the things that has happened after the Supreme Court's decision in 1993 in Daubert was judges started to be very rigorous in their evaluation on the civil side. So if plaintiffs were offering expert testimony on things like silicone implants or drugs or substances that might cause illnesses, they were excluding a lot of the experts. So on the civil side, where plaintiffs were offering it, they were being excluded. And defense companies like Merrill Dow Pharmaceuticals or Dow Corning would win, or Monsanto. But on the criminal side, they did not apply the same rigorous standard. And one explanation for that could be that if judges who very often were former prosecutors are more conservative politically, then that kind of regime works to exclude plaintiffs who are going against major, you know, corporations, but also allowing prosecutors in criminal cases.
Would this be a good time to ask our panelists to comment on the state of science education in the country and education on these subjects?
Well, I spent the last 30 years of my career trying to improve science education in the United States, and we haven't made much progress. For example, and I think you need to start science in elementary school. Years ago, 1990 or so, I got a big grant from the National Science Foundation to train all the elementary science teachers in San Francisco for 5 years. We had a great program with science kits, and that was the superintendent was Ray Cortinas, who then left, went to New York. And then the next superintendent wasn't interested in science education, so we killed that program. And today, it's very sad to think that I know, because many of my young people I know are teachers, that there's just almost no science in elementary school in San Francisco. That's been pushed out by the need to, you know, reading and math get all the attention. There's no time for science. And it's a real tragedy. So, I mean, I think the pandemic showed us that societies will not function well unless people understand how scientists reach judgments about vaccines, masks, climate change, all those things. The fact that former governor of Texas, who became the Secretary of Energy, could claim that climate change is a hoax made up by scientists to get grants. You know, you could never make that statement if the population knew anything about how science works. And so my focus for the last 3 or 4 years has been trying to get a new focus in science education, starting in elementary school, but at least in middle and high school, to teach people about how it is. We know that the warming of the earth, for example, is being caused by human activity. And how we know that, you know, how do we test vaccines? How do we know that they're safe? All those kinds of things come out of the scientific process. And it's always the same thing over and over, you know, scientists challenging each other, disputing, and then coming out of that big community effort, a consensus one way or the other that we need to rely on as societies if we're going to go forward. We can't have magical thinking. We can't think that, you know, ivermectin or vitamin A or whatever it is, some fad is going to cure measles or COVID or whatever. This is a disaster for society. We need to rely on what we know from science, and that won't happen well enough, I claim, unless we change the foundational teaching of science in schools so people actually understand the kind of things we're talking about today. You know, how do we know anything about DNA testing, or why do we know that, you know, the arson thing is not correct? And all these things need the scientific method to enable us to move forward in a coherent way. Otherwise, society is doomed. I mean, it's very sad.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I gave a talk at a university for a group of undergraduates, and one of the professors asked me, because I was complaining about the level of scientific sophistication among lawyers and judges and law students, and the professor asked, well, if there's one thing she could teach her undergraduates that might be on their way to law school, what would it be? And I thought about it for a moment, and I thought, hypothesis testing. So many of our students come to law school and then eventually become lawyers and judges and don't know how to go about fundamental testing of hypotheses. And I was involved in a program at Duke University years ago where another lecturer asked the judges to actually design a research study to evaluate whether taking a baby aspirin a day would lower your risk of heart disease. How would you do that? And the judges couldn't answer that question, or most of the judges could not answer that question, but it's one of the simplest design issues that you might have to do, you know, clinical testing. And so I do think that that's key. The other example I would give, I just recently was involved in a case in Sacramento. And in California, there are two tests that apply to whether scientific evidence is admissible. One of them is the Kelly-Frey test, which is that general acceptance test that we talked about earlier, where the question is whether the scientific evidence has become generally accepted among those in the field. But it also has a requirement that it has to be, it only applies to novel scientific evidence. And the argument that the defense counsel is making is that our understanding of firearms and tool marks today in 2025 is not the same as when it was first being admitted in 1915 or in 1995 or in 2010. And the judge had trouble understanding that point because he was relying on the precedent that this evidence had always been admitted. When science doesn't operate that way. The idea is that science questions and challenges received wisdom, and therefore in 2025 we should be able to challenge something that has been accepted for 100 years.
And that'll be the last word on it tonight. And you've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight we've discussed myriad. Tonight we've been talking about the intersection of law and science, known to us as forensic science. Joining me as co-host this evening is David Michael Bigelisen of San Francisco. Our guests tonight have been David Figman, the Dean of UC College of Law San Francisco, and Bruce Alberts, past president of the National Academy of Sciences, awarded the National Medal of Science by former President Barack Obama. I hope each of you will come back again, and thank you both for joining us tonight. May 1st, known as Law Day, celebrates the Constitution and the law. Recent events have gained our attention. Please join Your Legal Rights next week, where beginning at 6 o'clock, we take a look at Law Day, we take a look at the constitutional order, and just what condition it's in. Thanks again to all of our guests and to all of you for joining us. And at the controls for Joanne Marr, the magnificent Tarek Ansari. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, and zealously guard Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Jeff. Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.